This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 128. Today we present the concluding remarks in the Christ and Culture series from Daryl Hart. Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 128, and my name is Camden Busey. And today we are actually concluding our Christ in Culture series. It has been a long series, but one that I hope has been very informative and enjoyable to you. In this series, we have sought to bring together several different perspectives on the subject of Christ in Culture, and today we share the closing remarks from Dr. Daryl G. Hart. Dr. Hart teaches at Westminster Seminary, California, and Hillsdale College, and has authored several books on American Presbyterianism. And if you would like to hear each episode from rounds 1 and 2 and the other episodes from round 3 with Daryl Hart and our other participants, Nelson Klosterman, Bill Dennison, and Doug Wilson, please visit us online at reformedforum.org. There you will find our complete Christ and Culture series, as well as hundreds of other episodes on various issues in Reformed theology. But before we begin today's episode, let me mention that Christ the Center is listener-supported, and it does cost a bit to produce and to distribute our programs. And if you enjoy what we're doing here at Reformed Forum, please help us continue to produce content like this Christ and Culture series by sending us a donation to Reformed Forum at P.O. Box 27422, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19118. You can also visit us online and give electronically if you're able and willing, by visiting reformedforum.org and seeing the Donate Now button at the top of the page. We want to thank everyone for their support of Christ the Center and Reformed Forum. And so now let us hear Daryl Hart.
I'm not sure how much differences, I mean, in some ways differences came out. Somewhat more, but not, you know, generally speaking, everyone seems to say that we all agree at some level, except when you get down to the details. And so some of the details, I think, came out. I guess it depends on what parts of Reformed theology or teaching we're appealing to. And then also, I think a lot of it, though, has to do with where we're standing in the culture wars, so to speak, or just with regard to religion and politics, or religion and public life, or religion and culture in America. Maybe I'll just start off then by...
Do you suspect there's more differences than are being revealed or acknowledged?
Yeah.
Just in your personal interaction with each of these guys?
Well, I think I said this in the second round, but I think also it still remains that it seems like there's a fundamental discomfort that Wilson, Klosterman, and Dennison have with the unbeliever. And I'm not trying to say that I'm buddy-buddy with the unbeliever, and therefore, you know, look at me, aren't I great? But it's a question, again, of how far you press the antithesis. And whether it needs to be pressed all the way in the public realm or in the cultural realm. I know Doug uses the word radical to describe two kingdoms. And I think that would be, I think Klosterman would probably be comfortable with that. And I don't know what Bill would say to that. I think it's a compliment, actually, coming from Wilson, who describes himself as a post-millennial, Constantinian, Christendom-defending Protestant. I mean, at that point, what's the alternative to radical to kingdom? If you're willing to live with a emperor who is bishop of the church, so that's what a Constantinian is, it seems to me that that's pretty radical too, especially this side of 1789, both the French and American revolutions. So I don't understand what a moderate two kingdom view looks like that's Constantinian. So I mean I get a little annoyed with this idea of a radical two kingdom view when my view of the kingdom, I think I find squarely within the American revisions of the Westminster Standards. And I don't think Wilson would at all be comfortable with the Westminster Standards. I know that Klosterman isn't, since he keeps trying to bring up Article 36 of the Belgian Confession, which I want to say more about that. And I don't think necessarily that Wilson's comfortable with the American experiment, revolution, whatever you want to call it. So, you know, if it's radical to accept America, then I guess I'm a radical. But it seems to me, plus 200 years after the American Revolution and the disestablishment of religion that's been going on in Western societies since 1789, it's not at all radical to try to live with that. Mm-hmm. And Doug also tries to make it seem like the alternative to his view is Anabaptist. Well, that's just wrong historically. The alternative to both his and my view would be that the city council of Moscow, Idaho, calling pastors to be the pastors of the churches in Moscow, Idaho. That's what happened in the Calvin regime, the Luther regime. I don't think we want the magistrate to be calling pastors anymore. And that's one of the blessings that comes from the separation of church and state or the disestablishment of religion. The downside is some forms of secularization. But I just don't think that's a radical view. I don't think that's an Anabaptist view. And again, since the Westminster Standards, the American revisions of it accept those adjustments to the magistrate's role in religion. And since John Witherspoon himself was partly responsible for those revisions, and he was also a signer of the Declaration of Independence, again, I don't consider my view radical unless you're going to consider Witherspoon a radical. Now, let me just say, too, about Article 36 that Klosterman brought up regarding, not to use doctor or professor. I'm not trying to be disrespectful. It's just easier not to say Professor Klosterman every time. So I'm not sure which Article 30, which version of the Belgic he's appealing to, because I go online to the Christian Reformed Church's website, and I know he's no longer in the Christian Reformed Church, but the URC has yet to adopt which version of the confession, the Belgic, or the three forms they're using. Hmm. But the CRC's website on Article 36 says the very language that he used in his second round of interviews about the magistrate is to advance the kingdom of God, language to that effect. The the synods of 1958, but also building on the synods of 1910 and 1938, took that language out of Article 36 and said that language that he's using is unbiblical. Unbiblical is the word they use to describe that language. So, I mean, I would like to know from him how he thinks that language is biblical and where he dissents from his own tradition at that point. Or if he's the holder of the right tradition, or the right part of the tradition, I'd like to be instructed. I really would. But on the other hand, to try to claim that I need to own up to the language of Article 36 of the Belgian Confession it's not my confession of faith. My confession of faith is the American revisions of the Westminster Standards, adopted and readopted again by the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. That's what I am bound by. I'm not bound by Article 36, whichever version he's appealing to. So I don't know why, and I've encountered this in a number of blog conversations about how am I owning up to Article 36? It's not binding on me. I mean, it would be like me turning to him and saying the American revisions of the Westminster Standards are binding on him, since it's part of the Reformed tradition. I don't think he's comfortable with that. So, I mean, we're not going to go anywhere at that point, I guess. So that's one place to start, I guess. But further along those lines about church and state, Doug was saying, and I thought it was a helpful point as to a certain extent, about at the macro level, we all have a certain agreement about what the magistrate is called to do. But when we get down to the fine points, it becomes, when we zoom in, to use that lens metaphor, it's going to look different. Well, it seems to me that you can, that by appealing to gay marriage and abortion, you can try to show differences. But those are very inflammatory issues. They don't go to a whole lot of other issues that the state does. So Doug wants to say, I need to give a God account all the time of what I'm doing. Well, do I need to give a God account of why we drive on the right side of the street? I mean, if we're going to zoom all the way in, and I'm not denying that God is sovereign over driving. Of course God's sovereign over everything. But do we need to give a political, theological account of driving on the right side of the road when, in fact, our closest partners politically, America's closest partners politically has been the United Kingdom, and they drive on the left side of the road, at least in parts of the United Kingdom. So, I mean, if we're going to zoom all the way in, then don't we have to have sort of biblical or somehow Christian accounts of things like that? So to say, you can talk about abortion and gay marriage as being obvious, real moral crises of our moment historically. But, I mean, even then I would say that there are a lot of non-Christians and non-believers who don't think gay marriage is right, and they wouldn't give an account of natural law, but they have some sense that there is a moral right and wrong out there that I think they get from the created order, and I myself, if I were to be a politician, I wouldn't stand up in a press conference and say that I'm supporting legislation against gay marriage because of a particular Bible verse. I would say, trying to reflect the diversity of people that live in this polity, the United States, say that this is an experiment that we're not prepared to try, to actually have homosexual marriage. No one else has done this except for maybe the Greeks, and I'm not even sure the Greeks had gay marriage. So I'm just not ready to do that. I'm a conservative, and I believe that change has to be gradual. And maybe it's the case that certain states would want to experiment with that. And then how do you transfer that marriage from one state to another? That becomes a real problem, just like it became for slavery. How do you take your slaves from a slave state to a free state? So we get into a whole crisis of the American Republic and federalism again, conceivably, if that were to happen. But I think there'd be people who could say that this isn't right, and they don't need to go to the Bible to say it's not right. And I would also say that in the case of abortion, as heinous as I believe that is, even the people who support abortion recognize that murder is wrong. That's why they consider the fetus not to be human. That is a way of getting out of doing what they consider to be wrong, which is murder. So I'm not saying that their understanding of the fetus is right. I think it's jerry-rigged, and it's trying to combine the rights of women with the unborn somehow, but I still think that there's actually natural law elements in our current current culture's understanding of even these issues that I think we're generally getting wrong. So I don't think natural law is as bad as Wilson might make it out to be, nor do I think that a biblical account of these laws or a Christian account of law is going to get us nearly what Wilson seems to think we might get. So I guess that's a big part of what I was inspired to say, having listened to the Wilson and Klosterman interviews. I think another related point to what Doug was saying when he talked about public righteousness. I mean, I know that within Reformed tradition there's been talk of civil or civic righteousness. I know that's in Calvin as well. But I don't... I want to say more about postmillennialism, but since Doug described himself as postmillennialist, it suggests that public righteousness is a kind of righteousness that's going to lead to also spiritual or churchly righteousness in some way, that there's a great continuity in some ways between those two forms of righteousness. And this is where I really would echo a lot of what Bill Dennison was saying about discontinuity between earthly goods and the world to come. But when you start running down the road of public righteousness and postmillennialism, it seems to me you're headed for a misunderstanding of the nature of sinfulness and how much that still clings to us, even to the good works of believers. And if you want to talk about public righteousness leading in some way to the coming of the kingdom of Christ or of God, where does Christ's righteousness fit in that, and the need for faith to receive Christ's righteousness? So I really struggle with that idea of a kind of public righteousness being used to usher in the kingdom in some way, and to suggest that there's some kind of continuity between the good that unbelievers do and the righteousness that will come with Christ's reign. And on that point of the millennium, when Doug says we have all the time in the world for this to work out, which he said a number of times so that he could understand my concerns about people talking this way now, but over time we'll be able to figure out a Christian way of doing medicine, a Christian way of doing law or whatever. Well, how does he know when Christ's going to return? What if Christ returns tomorrow? I mean, so, but he made it seem like that a postmillennialist has all the time in the world that we can figure this out. Well, does he have insight that Harold Camping also has about when Christ is going to return, except for him it's going to be in 3,000 years? I just think most of us are ignorant about when Christ is going to return. And so that doesn't really answer my objection about what Christian law looks like, or what Christian art looks like, or what Christian music might look like, or what Christian education looks like. And on top of all that, I mean, to go back to the historical argument about living on this side of 1789, Christendom had 1,500 years to simmer and percolate. And I would argue that one of the things that the Reformation saw was that Christendom wasn't going real well. And whenever you begin to conflate society or politics and the church the way that Christendom did, then I would say also the way that the social gospel did with the mainline churches, late 19th, early 20th centuries, you lose the gospel. So I'm not confident that we're going to get it right again. In fact, I think that's just inviting another recipe for getting the gospel wrong and really not having a clear distinction between what is necessary for salvation and what is maybe a nice way to order a society and to live relatively peaceably. So that's another concern about Mr. Wilson. And so I still kind of remain befuddled by both Doug and Nelson over what Christian culture, Christian politics, Christian law might look like. And this, I guess, could lead into the other, and this is where I'd engage Bill Dennison some. Both the Article 4 of the Canons of Dort from third and fourth heads of doctrine or points of doctrine was invoked several times against the natural law position. And I'm not sure that I'm really a natural law defender. I mean, I'm a novice in this. I'm much more of a spirituality of the church person, and I kind of make it up as I go from there. But Article 4 of that, of Dort in third and fourth main points of doctrine reads, "There is, to be sure, a certain light of nature remaining in man after the fall, by virtue of which he retains some notions about God, natural things, and the difference between what is moral and immoral, and demonstrates a certain eagerness for virtue and for good outward behavior." That's all that natural law people, I think, are saying, is that there is a certain light of nature remaining that allows people to be good outwardly. So far, so good. But then, here comes a but. "But this light of nature is far from enabling man to come to a saving knowledge of God and conversion to him. So far, in fact, that man does not use it rightly, even in matters of nature and society." So that seems to undermine the whole, but it doesn't undermine it. It just means that they're not using it rightly to the glory of God and to the real nature of what true righteousness would be. So they don't have that other stuff, the illumination, regeneration of the Holy Spirit, those sorts of things that would enable people to use all that natural light to the glory of God. But it doesn't mean that because the certain light that they've already affirmed in the first sentence here of Article 4, now they're saying, oh, that doesn't exist anymore. They're saying that natural light exists, but it doesn't exist to the point of allowing people to do this for the glory of God and for true righteousness' sake. And they go on to conclude this article by saying, "Instead, in various ways, he completely distorts this light, whatever its precise character, and suppresses it in unrighteousness. In doing so, he renders himself without excuse before God." Again, I agree with that entirely. I agree with that the unregenerate person does suppress all that good stuff that he or she may figure out from the natural order, but they suppress it in unrighteousness, and they can't use it for any way for their own salvation. But they still use it for good ends in this world, that we can live with them and trust them as our neighbors. And I guess, again, this comes to the point of the antithesis and how much we are at odds with people by virtue of their suppressing this knowledge and unrighteousness, or do they have enough that we can live with them and trust them as neighbors and even as rulers and as physicians and as architects? If Doug and Bill and Nelson want to appeal to that article in the way that I think they're appealing to it, then I should only trust physicians who are Christian, lawyers who are Christian, all these people who have been illuminated by the Holy Spirit and can read natural light or the general light of nature correctly. Only those people should I go to trust. I mean, I don't think they live their lives that way, zooming all the way in, to use Doug's analogy again. I think we driving down the street, we trust people all the time that they're going to stay on the right side of the road.
Somebody today almost hit me by not reading an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. But fortunately...
Well, at least it wasn't a phone. So, I mean, we would never go out of the house if we really believed that unbelievers could not do some things rightly. And then I would extend that and say, I can trust my finances to them, I can trust my health to them, and I can trust the polity of the United States to them. I don't need to have Christian people doing all those things for me. Would it be better if all Christians were running America? I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, it's not as if European society in 1700 or 1650 was great. So, you know, I think, again, a big difference between me and the other guests is how much we're willing to live with the differences and willing to trust people who are different from us with positions of responsibility and authority. I think if you read that part of the Canons of Dort in the way that Doug and Nelson are suggesting it, and Bill as well, then you just don't trust other people. So that's another area. But and so I guess that would lead then to maybe the disagreements between Klosterman and me about education, which is, I think he appealed to that same article in the second round as far as what does that mean for Christian schools, Christian education, et cetera. I would really like to see someone write more about this and take instruction, but I don't think the illumination of from the Holy Spirit that allows people to see the truth of the gospel and embrace Christ offered in the gospel gives believers then some sort of powers of discernment about Shakespeare or biology or chemistry, that all of a sudden they're great interpreters of the natural world by virtue of grace. I think they're most people who are good interpreters of the world do so by virtue of being smart and wise. And I would argue, and I don't know if I did this in a previous interview, and so you could edit this out, I guess. But, I mean, I would argue that theism is very important. So the writers, the non-Christian or heterodox writers that I value most about life in this world are all theists. They all believe that there is a creative order of some kind. There's a God, and we are creatures, and therefore we are to live lives in some way in reverence in light of that reality. So I think that being a theist is really pretty important. Being a God-fearer is pretty important. But pagans were God-fearers. It's a very rare American who doesn't fear God, if you look at the polling data, at least. So yes, I think theism is pretty important, and maybe even polytheism is pretty important for some kind of moral code among people, and that atheism could lead to real anarchy if that were somehow established in our laws and our culture. This is why, again, I think we need to give two cheers for the disestablishment of religion in the late 18th century. When Christians were running the show, we had only one of the serious periods in the history of Europe after the Reformation was the 30 Years' War, where not only were Protestants and Roman Catholics killing each other, but Protestants were killing each other. And so a Christian state isn't any guarantee of peace and tranquility. And so what happened over time from the 1630s on down to 1780s was people decided to decouple religion and public life and figure out another way to try to order society. And that finally brought an end to the Constantinian arrangement. It has problems. It has defects. That's why I only give it two cheers as opposed to three. But I really think we're better off in this arrangement than we are as Reformed people living in Saxony or somewhere in 1640 getting our heads cut off or shot. I'm not sure about the details of that. Or I'm not entirely comfortable with executing Arians in the 4th century for their views, which is what the Christian state did, I think. So you know, again, zooming in to the micro level of things, what are we going to do with blasphemy and idolatry? Are we going to punish those things if we think that that the state needs to recognize the true religion, that we need to give biblical accounts of our laws, etc.? So I guess the application to the realm of education is that if regeneration does not give us special knowledge about the world of nature and society and human nature, which I do not think it does, and I think if you're going to claim any kind of special knowledge, that's kind of Gnostic. I mean, I'm not saying it is Gnostic, but it's kind of. I mean, I think we got to be careful of that danger to say that somehow Christians have special knowledge by virtue of regeneration. And there's plenty of empirical evidence to suggest that they don't have special knowledge. But so if that's off the table, then it seems to me I can learn as much from William Roski in Shakespeare class 1603 to 1623 as I could from somebody who was a Christian. And I don't know what Bill Roski was, my Temple prof when I was a senior at Temple, but it was a wonderful course. I learned a ton about Shakespeare and about Elizabethan society and early Stuart society, and I wouldn't have any hesitation if I had children, sending my children to study with someone like William Roski. Yeah. So, I don't understand why we need to be fearful of people like that. I can understand why we need to be fearful of people like
Singer.
Yeah. But I mean, again, those are cases like abortion and gay marriage that can inflame people. But that's the exception, it seems to me. It's not the rule. Maybe I'm being overly naive, but I don't think I am. I guess another related point here is that I didn't hear much on the other guests in the other guest interviews about Christian liberty. And it does seem to me that even when, if you think you can give a biblical account of something, as I think all Christians try to do, it doesn't mean that the way that I live my life in areas outside the church are ways that you should live your life. I mean, Christian liberty suggests that we have different levels of conscience and how we will approach living our lives faithfully before God. So the amount of television that I watch might be different from the amount of television you watch. The content of the television programming may be different from the content that someone else will watch. And if we're going to try to zoom in and have the church discipline believers on Wednesday night just as much as they're discipling on Sunday, another phrase that Doug used, it seems to me that the church has to have a thus saith the Lord to do that. And in a whole realm of human activity, the church has no thus saith the Lord. That's why communions like the OPC have been remarkably unwilling to take all sorts of stands on a host of issues, because there's no clear thus saith the Lord that can bind everyone in the communion to that standard. You know, the general standard being that we should do all to the glory of God, or that we should submit to rulers, or things like that, those are all true. But then how each believer applies that in his or her own life is going to be different. So there will be some Christians who will vote for Democrats, and there will be some Christians who wouldn't ever think of voting for a Democrat. But I don't know any kind of litmus test that we could derive successfully, responsibly from Scripture that would say, never vote for a Democrat. And, you know, I understand that the Democrats are the party of pro-choice, but that's not all that they stand for.
And they're moderate Republicans.
Right. So if that becomes a litmus test for how people vote, you know, that's one thing. But I'm not sure how the church ever would come to that conclusion to say that you're not a good Christian if you vote aside from a single issue. So, I mean, I really do think that in these discussions about church and politics, Christianity and culture, Christ and culture, some understanding of Christian liberty needs to be on the table, since that it seems to me that's a very important part of the Reformed tradition and what does distinguish us in some respects, especially when it comes to worship, from Lutherans, that the church may only do in worship what the Bible requires, and aside from that, the church may not do what the Bible requires. And Lutherans don't hold to that view, so Lutherans will do other things in worship that Reformed people won't do. And by a similar analogy, that extends to other areas of life. And so I would make a plea for more attention to Christian liberty from those who think that a biblical or Christian account needs to be given of legal, political, cultural matters. Now, I haven't said too much about Bill so far.
Did you make it through his round two?
Twice. I would applaud him again on the matter of discontinuity between culture of this world and culture of the world to come. So I think he really makes a very helpful corrective to some of the other voices on the other side, with Doug and Klosterman in particular. I do find it, and I think too that he has a very good critique of looking at the culture of this life somehow extending into the culture of the life to come. And he had a very, I think he used the word of works righteousness, applying that term to that understanding of culture. And I, again, would very much second that notion. I think that is a form of works righteousness, and one of the reasons why I want to distinguish so clearly between the two kingdoms, so to speak, or between the church and the world, is to make sure that we get the gospel, keep the gospel straight. And so Christ's righteousness is different from works righteousness. It's even different from good works of Christians, because good works of Christians are still filthy rags. But on the other hand, when, you know, and this is in some ways beside the point, it's more of a theological discussion than a culture or a Christ and culture discussion. But when Bill talks about grace is never separated from obedience, and that the gospel can never, or that the law and obedience and faith always go together, and the way he expounded the Decalogue and its treatment in the larger and shorter catechism, I mean, I wish he would extend the same fears about works righteousness into that. And I think when you make obedience and faith so close together, the way Bill did, at least in his remarks for the interview, it seems to me that you do enter into thinking that could lead to a kind of works righteousness on the part of believers. Again, that's a theological conversation, but I just thought it was interesting that he would be so cautious about a works righteousness applied to culture, but not as cautious about applying that to the good works of believers. And, you know, I think it's interesting what the Shorter Catechism says. I mean, the Shorter Catechism expounds the law after expounding the application of redemption and Christ's works of redemption. And then from 85 on, it goes into the means of grace. And it starts that section by saying, in question and answer 85, what does God require to escape the wrath and curse due to us for sin? So the law has already been expounded, and it's not that the law is now being expounded to say this is what God requires to escape the wrath and curse of God. It says that faith and repentance and the diligent use of the means of grace are the things that God requires to escape the wrath and curse do to us for sin. Now, I understand repentance can include a lot of things that might go into the law, but it doesn't seem to me that it's saying faith and good works are necessary to escape the wrath and curse of God. The law has already been expounded, and now it's asking this other question, and I think it's useful to keep that distinction in mind. But again, that's a theological conversation, and less maybe more for the cultural one. But when it comes to culture, and for Bill to say things like there are only two cultures, and I think he said he was applauding that when Klosterman said the thing. I just don't have any understanding of what that possibly means, that there are only two cultures, when we talk all the time about American culture, Canadian culture, British culture. But to give it real specificity, a big part of culture is language. That's what immigrants coming to a new society always have to face, is if the culture doesn't speak the same language, it takes 2 to 3 generations for those groups to finally assimilate into the new culture because of language barriers. Okay, so language is very important to culture. And there aren't two languages. If there are two cultures, there would only be two languages. And to my knowledge, there's no Christian language, unless you want to be a Pentecostal and say that speaking in tongues is a Christian language, which I don't think Bill would want to say. So to get down from this God versus Satan cosmic battle that I do believe is being played out, and it's being played out in English culture and German culture and French culture and all these different languages. But still, to go into those areas of cultural endeavor, when you talk about language, I don't think Christians have a English grammar that's different from non-Christians' English grammar. So there's a cultural life that Christians and non-Christians, again, share together by virtue even of something like language. And it's not something that Christians or anyone creates. We inherit our language from the get-go. And granted, it changes and evolves, and we make contributions, and so that sons and daughters, grandchildren, will have a different way of speaking than us. But it's still the English language, and you can still read Chaucer and make out what's going on in Chaucer, even though it's a different kind of English. So I don't know what good is done by insisting on this cosmic battle between God and Satan, and saying, therefore, there are only two cultures. Again, making my point that I'm not sure of why we need to insist upon the antithesis at that level. And again, it doesn't make sense when it comes to something like language. And I would study gladly with a linguist like John McWhorter, who used to teach it at Berkeley. I'm not sure if he's still there. And have children study with him. To learn about English grammar and good uses of grammar and good ways of writing and speaking, then having to say only those who belong to God are on that side of the antithesis are people to whom I should trust when it comes to cultural matters. Now, I'm not saying that's what Bill necessarily holds, and I'm not saying that that's the way he lives his life, but the way he theorizes about it would suggest that that's the direction in which he'd want to go. And if I had to observe that, I don't think I'd go outside the apartment, and I don't know that I would go to any other website than the OPC.org. One other point that I'd say to Bill, I'd say it to him in person too. When he thinks that the two kingdom is a cultural response to a culture that is obsessed with politics, I don't know what he's talking about. I mean, I get it that our culture is obsessed with politics. And the stuff that I've written on spirituality of the church and two kingdoms has been precisely in reaction to the religious right and using the gospel to try to make America a Christian place. So I'm pushing precisely in the same direction that he's pushing, and yet he seems to think that I'm obsessed with politics. I'm much more obsessed with the church. My blog is all about church stuff. I hardly ever write about about politics, except when the church, when Christians speak, I think, foolishly about politics. So, I mean, the two-kingdom view is really trying to do what Bill thinks should be done, which is to get Christians out of the public square and thinking that the public square is where redemptive activity is really happening, because I think Bill is right. It's not happening there. It's happening in the church. Thoroughly applaud that, and the two kingdoms is the way, is at least one way that I know of to get there. So again, I'm not sure why the need to sort of portray me as being obsessed with politics. I mean, I'm not taking it personally, but I just don't think that's a fair reading of what I've tried to do. So let's see. I think those are the main points that I considered in listening to all three interviews. Mm-hmm. So,
do you have any final concluding remarks, just in terms of anything you've realized or become aware of just in this interaction?
Well, I think I have. I mean, it's not just simply through this, but also through some of the reactions to different posts on the blog, that people have a really, I think, strange misconception of two kingdoms. I mean, I remember someone saying that, being surprised that I would oppose abortion since I'm a two-kingdom person. There is this bogeyman, and unfortunately, I think people like Doug and Bill have created it. I mean, I'm sorry, Doug and Nelson. I don't think Bill has been as public in creating that bogeyman of the two kingdom. And again, the use of the word radical is indicative of this. That suggests to people that these people don't believe in the Lord. They're just antinomian. Hmm. And that's precisely not the case. What, in fact, the two kingdom view is trying to do is to recognize ways in which we can have an orderly and lawful society without having everybody as Christian, without having to kick out all the non-Christians. Hmm. We're trying to come up with a way of recognizing the good, the limited, very penultimate, not even penultimate good that exists among our non-Christian neighbors and friends, and say, this is a way that we can live together. And it's a way also for Christians to live with those people and not feel like they have violated their consciences. Now, I understand there may be people who still feel like they cannot abide with that kind of two-kingdom arrangement. And that's fine. I don't know what planet they want to live on, because I don't know that it's possible to live anywhere with the sort of view that Christianity gives you insight into the natural world. And therefore, that suggests that only Christians should be rulers, or only Christians that I trust should be doctors or whatever. I don't know where you could live that way. I mean, I do know that there are Christian Yellow Pages, and there are people who do try to use only Christian businesses. And that's fine. I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing. I think that's truly capable of being manipulated. But again, I just think we walk outside our homes, our apartments, or wherever, and we're cheek by jowl in a world where unbelievers live and move and have their being. And so how can we live with them? And how can we especially live with them in a way that gives us the freedom to worship and the freedom to proclaim the gospel to those very same people? As John Fitzgerald Kennedy explained to the Baptist ministers in Houston during the 1960 campaign, that it's a great speech. It's available online at a website whose address I cannot remember. And Roman Catholics hate the speech because it's Kennedy privatizing and saying that he can be a good Catholic and uphold the Constitution, and therefore he doesn't need to obey the Pope or a bishop. So I can understand why that's a problem for Roman Catholics, but his point in that speech was that if the state today can exclude Roman Catholics from office, the state tomorrow can exclude Presbyterians from citizenship or other things. So again, why isn't it a good thing that we have uncoupled or decoupled, whichever the word is, the state and the church, and even the state and the university, I mean the church and the university, the church and the school, and given people the capacity to appreciate the insights of non-believers, and also given Christians the liberty to pursue areas of their callings that the church really doesn't have authority over. I think it's a, I mean, I'm not usually that happy a person, but I think it's a wonderful arrangement. And again, it has defects, but that's because we live on this side of the new heavens and new earth. So it seems to me every effort to try to make the culture or the society or this estate mirror the norms of the church is to immanentize the eschaton. And as a conservative, I know that's wrong politically. And as a philosophy, I know that's wrong.
Thank you for listening to this installment of our Christ and Culture discussion. We hope you enjoyed the whole thing, and let us know what you think by emailing us at mail@reformedforum.org, or you can Twitter us @ReformedForum. And again, Christ the Center is listener-supported, and please help us continue to produce content like this Christ and Culture series by sending a donation to Reformed Forum at P.O. Box 27422, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania 19118. Or by visiting us online at reformedforum.org and clicking on the Donate Now button at the top of each page. But thank you so much for listening. Thank you for all your support, monetary and prayer. And we look forward to having you back next time on Christ the Center.